Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, February 1st, 2018.
I'm Todd Zwillich. This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us today. We begin with a look at the State of the Union in America, not the one President Trump gave on Tuesday, but the ones everyday workers participate in and how they've changed in recent years.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in our union, the union.
Billy Bragg says there's power in the unions, but how much remains in America? That's our first question on The Takeaway today. In 1983, over 20% of American workers belonged to a union. 35 years later, that number has been cut in half, about 10% today. But there are some small signs of life for unions. In just the past 2 weeks, employees at media companies Slate, Vox, and the Los Angeles Times have all voted to unionize. We'll have more on the situation at the LA Times later in the show. We're also going to check in with a small town paper where journalists are facing layoffs. There is a union push in journalism right now. In academia, too. Our own workplace here at WNYC in New York is a union shop. Many workers, including me, have been members of the SAG-AFTRA labor union for years. In total, white-collar fields like entertainment, law, and journalism have seen modest increases in union membership, up about 4% since 2010. But contrast that to manufacturing, where the percentage of union workers has fallen by about 3% since 2010, and, as we said, dramatically since its heyday in the 1980s. One high-profile bid came at a Nissan plant in Mississippi over the summer that we covered at the time with actor and activist Danny Glover.
This affects not only Nissan workers. This may be the epic center for the new civil rights issue within the 21st century workers.
Nissan workers in that case did not vote to unionize, and neither did 7,500 Boeing employees in South Carolina last February.
South Carolina, among other particularly southern states, they've made their pitch to companies as a low-cost, low-wage, non-union state, and so they view it as a hit to that competitiveness if they start becoming known as a place where workers will actually vote to unionize.
UNC Chapel Hill law professor Jeff Hirsch on this show last year. So what's behind the success of white-collar union efforts, even while lower-wage industries struggle to gain acceptance even among the workers they want to represent? What does it say about the state of a divided American economy? Ruth Milkman is a labor sociologist at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She joins me in the studio now. Ruth, welcome.
Hi.
Well, what's going on in industries like journalism that they've seen this surge in unionizing while unions in many other industries are falling by the wayside?
Well, so the falling by the wayside part is very easy to address because that's a very long-term trend that's been going on since at least 1980, 1981, when President Reagan fired the air traffic controllers. You may remember that.
I must tell those who failed to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law. And if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated. End of statement.
So in the private sector particularly, employers have been extremely hostile to unionism for many decades now. And the South is notorious for that, but it's actually true all over the country in private sector industries. The recent development that you're interested in of this surge of interest in unionism among young journalists is very interesting, although I must caution you to say that the numbers are quite modest so far. We're talking about maybe a couple thousand people altogether, which in the U.S. labor market of 140 million workers is a drop in the bucket. So even if all journalists in the millennial generation were to become union members, it wouldn't really affect the overall picture all that much. So that's just the kind of caveat. But to answer your question, I think what's driving it is that young, highly educated, college-educated workers, especially since the Great Recession of 2008, are facing a situation where the expectations that they had of the workplace are not being met in a very extreme way. So as this workforce, which kind of to get a job in journalism, as I'm sure you know very well, is quite challenging, quite competitive. These are the cream of the cream, the cream of the crop. They are very skilled young journalists. And now they face a labor market where work is extremely insecure, not very well paid, tremendous turmoil. You never know from one week to the next if you're going to be employed, not treated very well by the employers in many cases. And so the natural thing is to look for some kind of response to that. And in this case, it's taking the form of traditional labor unionism. It's not actually that unusual for college-educated workers to unionize. In the public sector, they're more unionized than other workers. Think of teachers, nurses, social workers. All those groups have been unionized for a long time. In the private sector, it's a little different. And the opposition is there among the employers in this sector, just like it is in North Carolina and South Carolina and Nissan, right? It's everywhere. But maybe these workers are a little less intimidated by the threats that employers make than less educated workers who also have many fewer options in the workforce.
Is there a risk of stratification here, though, further stratification in the economy, where, yeah, I understand journalism is a very small sector of the overall economy, but you see movements to unionize in sectors of journalism, in academia as well, where huge sectors of workers in the rest of the economy are basically seeing unions go away? What does that say about the economy more broadly?
Well, if this developed into a really large-scale trend, that might become an issue. Right now, we're talking about a couple thousand people. It really doesn't do much to affect that larger trend. The divide is there. It's not caused by anything to do with unionism. It's been there for a long time, and it's growing, and college-educated workers are doing way better than other workers, and that gap is intensifying partly because of the decline of unions in traditional blue-collar jobs. So again, if this were to really take off as a sort of major trend, then you'd have an issue. Right now, I think it's just a glimmer of possibility. We're seeing, you know, some very interesting developments in this group, but I don't think it has any impact on the larger economic divide.
Well, are there other industries that could take the cue from journalism and academia? Could this spread, or is this going to be limited to kind of an idiosyncratic little corner of the economy?
I don't think anyone knows the answer to that. I certainly don't. What I will say is that historically, when unionism has taken off, it has spread across sectors very rapidly. When workers see that it's possible to organize collectively and, you know, that success is out there among some other group. I mean, if you look back to the 1930s, which is the biggest upsurge of unionism ever, it started in manufacturing, but quickly spread to department stores, restaurants, everywhere. So I suppose there's a possibility that this could be the beginning of something big, but I don't see any evidence for that just yet.
Well, let's talk about manufacturing for just a minute. This is not a new trend. It goes back, you said, to the start, to the 80s, when unionism really started to wane in this country. But when you look at the recent votes across the South, these were auto workers themselves voting not to unionize,
right?
Not necessarily a question of management crushing the union the way it, you know, would happen in the 30s. These were workers saying no. We don't want it.
Well, you got to put it in a bigger context. So it's true that in the 30s, management would hire thugs and Pinkertons to beat people up, sometimes even murder them when they tried to unionize. We don't see that today. But we do see management everywhere hiring what they call labor consultants, what people in the labor movement call union busters, who use all sorts of legal and sometimes illegal tactics to fight unionism and to intimidate workers who are presented with the prospect of voting yes or no on a union. And that definitely happened in these cases. And actually, there's also often opposition from politicians, elected officials in communities where unionism is attempted, who are fearful that if the union does succeed, that somehow this will make it more difficult for them to attract new investment and so on. So there's tremendous intimidation going on. It's not physical, it's intellectual and threats to close plants, firing activists. All these things happen routinely in the private sector, not just in manufacturing, but including there. And again, the South is sort of particularly notorious for this, but it's by no means limited to the South or to manufacturing, I might add.
Ruth, we're in an economy now where independent contracting, the sharing economy, Lyft driving, Uber driving, all of these things are getting more and more popular. Unions are on the wane. Yes, there are one or two little industries where unions are becoming more popular. But the message behind what you're saying here today, and when you look out across the economy, is that increasingly for the American worker, you're on your own.
That's absolutely right. And independent contractors, by the way, which, as you said, is a growing phenomenon, a lot of employers are converting what had been regular wage and hour salaried employment into independent contracting. And the reason for that is that those workers are actually not considered employees legally, and they're not eligible for unionization under our labor law. So that's part of what this is about. Plus, they're not protected by things like minimum wage laws. So there are all kinds of reasons why that trend is growing that are not unrelated to what we've been talking about.
So lots and lots of unions, Ruth, are struggling for relevance, struggling to sign up new workers, struggling to win union elections. They've tried to find other strategies to affect the labor market. $15 minimum wage is one example, right? How successful overall have those efforts been, even if, let's say, McDonald's and Burger King workers across America are not in a union?
Those efforts have been extremely successful, not by the metric of acquiring new union members, because I don't think there's been a single one acquired through this campaign, the Fight for 15. However, that fight, which is bankrolled by one of the largest unions in the United States, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, that has led to campaigns all over the country, particularly in blue states and cities, to raise the minimum wage. And many jurisdictions have done so. They've raised it to $15 an hour over, you know, phasing it in over a period of time. And that's probably done more for low-wage workers than almost anything you can think of in recent years. So I think that's probably been the single most effective campaign. It may eventually lead to some growth in unionization, but there's no sign of that thus far. Yet it's been extremely important. And maybe I can just add one other comment on that, which is that people think of unions as only caring about their members, which is right now a very small part of the labor force, about 1 in 10 workers who are union members. Historically, that's not been true. Unions have fought for things like increases in the minimum wage over many decades, and this is just the latest iteration of that.
Ruth Milkman, City University of New York, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have an experience unionizing at your company?
Yes, I am trying to establish a union myself at this point in a company that I work for. And I think that one of the things the union should do is put out ads again, like the one that was look for the union label, which is really catchy and everybody looks at it. And it's a patriotic thing to want unions because it makes the entire nation a stronger nation.
Hi, my name is Larry. I'm calling from Southeast Pennsylvania. I think we need to be careful in the whole subject of unionization, that we don't win the battle but lose the war in a global economy.
Hi, my name is Nina. I'm a union painter. I work for Philadelphia Housing Authority, and I'm super protected by my union. Get great benefits, holidays, 6 days. So for me, the union has worked out very well.
Hello, my name is Dave. I live in Bellingham, Washington. I belong to a union, Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, also known as Wobblies. We have a totally different perspective on unionism. Our union is growing. Our attitude is we don't get hung up in contract negotiations so much as workers taking direct action on the job. We sign up individual members into the union. We do not wait for an NLRB election or formal union recognition. Workers are protected by labor law and by the solidarity of our other members and other unions who back us up.
My name is Alice from Andover. The last time a group of employees band together to challenge unfair wages at my company, they were told that they could protest all they wanted, but their job security would not be guaranteed.
This is George from Beaver County, Pennsylvania. I've been a member of the Carpenters Union for over 20 years, and we have more extensive training in all the building trades than any non-union trade has. Most times a five-year apprenticeship program and a wage and a retirement and health benefits.
My name is Mark Atchison. I'm calling from Plymouth. I belong to a new union down in Plymouth, Massachusetts at the Plymouth Plantation. And we won our union election last year, but management has hired a union-busting lawyer. And our negotiations are stuck, and we're in the midst of a possible recall election to force the union out.
Those were all responses to today's podcast question. Want to know what we're going to feature tomorrow? Maybe be part of the show? Sign up to be part of our listener response network. You can text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply, and you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, that's START to 69866 to join our listener response network. A story now from the front lines of the opioid crisis in America. 884 people died of drug overdoses in West Virginia in 2016, and opioids were the main driver of those deaths. That's according to the CDC's latest numbers, which make West Virginia the state with the highest overdose death rate in America. Well, in one small town in West Virginia, a piece of this very big problem is coming into focus. An investigation by the House Committee on Energy and Commerce has found that drug wholesalers sent nearly 21 million prescription opioid pills to Williamson, West Virginia, between 2006 and 2016. 21 million pills to a town of only about 3,000 people. This was first reported this week by the Charleston Gazette-Mail in West Virginia, a local paper that won a Pulitzer for its opioid reporting. And Eric Ayer is behind all of that. He's State House reporter for the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Eric, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Eric, we're talking about hydrocodone, basically Vicodin, and oxycodone, basically Oxycontin. 21 million tablets that made it to this town. How did that happen?
Well, it happened over the course of a decade. And this congressional committee has identified two major suppliers, their regional suppliers. And there was a connection between the pharmacies and a pain clinic in that town that's since been shut down. Pharmacies had ordered this high volume of pills over the course of 10 years. It was supplied by the wholesalers to the pharmacy, then distributed to the people who attended the pain clinic.
Well, give us a little bit of an idea of how this worked. Two small pharmacies in one tiny town, distributors, some of them out of state, pumping huge amounts of opioid prescriptions into these two pharmacies. People at these places, these businesses, must have known this wasn't all for healthcare. So what was going on?
Yeah, I wasn't there at the time, but we've seen photos of people lined up around the block, and there's been some video footage that has been released. You had people coming from all over the area, from other states. The pharmacies were actually just a couple blocks from the pain clinic, and the pharmacies themselves were just four blocks apart. So you just had this picture of massive number of people and massive number of painkillers being distributed.
What about the distributors themselves sending all these millions, tens of millions of tablets to just these two pharmacies? I know that business was good. They were making lots of money, so I get the incentive structure there. But people there had to have known, again, that this wasn't all about pain relief and good medicine.
Yes, and the letters, they outline two things from the congressional committee, the letters that were distributed to these drug wholesalers. First off, there was high volume shipments to both pharmacies over consecutive days. And the other thing they point out in the letters is there were huge spikes in pain pill numbers from year to year. So one year you'd have 100,000 hydrocodone or oxycodone distributed by this particular drug wholesaler. And the next year it would be 1 to 2 million hydrocodone. So they saw these huge, huge spikes, and there was no explanation yet from the drug wholesalers.
And why didn't those huge spikes set off an alarm somewhere, or did it, but the money was so good that people just ignored it?
Well, I think it set off an alarm. The feds did shut down the pain clinic. Both of the pharmacies that filled the prescriptions for this notorious pain clinic are still open, however, although under new management, we understand. A couple things. DEA has said that they didn't have enough manpower at the time. Most of these shipments were in the 2008 to 2012 period, that they had a lack of manpower and that there was a lack of leadership in West Virginia. Plus, our Board of Pharmacy at the time wasn't enforcing rules that would have helped identify these quote-unquote suspicious shipments.
What's been the reaction from the county and from the state of West Virginia? You mentioned that laws and regulations that could have caught this huge high volume weren't being enforced at the time. What are they saying now?
There has been some movement by the Board of Pharmacy. They have enforced rules that have been on the books for years that they're requiring these distributors to report suspicious orders from pharmacies. That in part has led to a 12% reduction in hydrocodone and oxycodone over the previous year in terms of total number of pills distributed. The big change, though, is now all these counties and cities in these areas that were flooded with pills, they filed lawsuits against the drug distributors and the pharmacies and the doctors seeking to recoup what they say were the ravages, the economic impacts of all the drug abuse in their areas.
Eric, meanwhile, the Justice Department announced this week a crackdown on overprescribing through the DEA, presumably targeting the types of doctors who were sending these many hundreds, thousands of patients to Williamson in your story. What's the federal crackdown look like?
Well, it may be too little too late because the problem has shifted mostly to heroin and fentanyl, although pills are still running three or four behind in the drug overdose death rates. And again, I've heard this year after year, there's always talk that this is our number one priority, that we're going to do a crackdown. Yet the overdose rates, the drug overdose rates continue to climb. And West Virginia, as you know, has the highest drug overdose death rate in the nation. And these counties in particular that were bombarded with pills have some of the highest drug overdose death rates in the nation among counties.
So just to be clear, it sounds like now that the crackdown is coming from the feds, cracking down on prescription legal pills, the epidemic has moved on to illicit drugs that you won't find in the doctor's office.
Right. However, I will say that there's been a number of studies nationally and in West Virginia that even though the people are dying of drug overdoses caused by heroin and fentanyl, and actually now methamphetamine is a leading drug overdose cause, that many of them, upwards of 50%, had a prescription within the previous year for a pain pill. So the pills are still in the mix. It's just that the volumes of the pills that we saw 4 or 5 years ago have declined significantly.
Eric Ayer is State House reporter for the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Eric, I want to thank you for all the reporting that you've done in your community and across West Virginia for the whole country.
Well, thank you for having me on.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway. Eric Ayer, who you just heard from there a moment ago, won a Pulitzer Prize last April for his reporting on the opioid crisis in West Virginia. Less than a year later, the Charleston Gazette-Mail, where Ayer won his Pulitzer, announced this week they're filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Right now, everybody is very worried. We've all received layoff notices. We understand that we're going to have to reapply for our jobs. So it's a very... very difficult time right now in our newsroom for everybody.
Difficult times in the newsroom, but the Gazette-Mail isn't alone. In mid-January, the East Bay Times in Oakland, California announced a round of layoffs after winning a Pulitzer last year as well for reporting on failures that led to a massive deadly warehouse fire. We want to get some insight into what's going on at these local papers on the front lines of public service journalism. We turn to Christopher Alley, assistant professor in the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia.
It suggests a trend that we've been seeing of metro daily newspapers really struggling to find profit and sustainable revenue in the digital age. It also suggests that we need to remind ourselves that great journalism doesn't always translate into profits and revenues, that newspapers and other local news organizations need to survive.
You know, some newspapers these days survive on advertising. Others charge a subscription, a paywall, to read their coverage. What about smaller local papers? Can they charge subscriptions online these days and still get by?
Absolutely, they can. I think what we're realizing more and more for all newspapers of every size, from the largest, you know, major metros and national dailies down to the mom and pop weeklies, is that advertising and subscription alone will not be sustainable in terms of revenue. These newspapers have to diversify. They have to experiment with different revenue-driven structures. You know, you might look at paywalls, for instance. You might look at website hosting or other design features. There's a lot of ways that newspapers can make money beyond just advertising and subscription. And I really do think that that's going to be the future for local newspapers.
So what's working in local news right now in terms of not only survival, but local papers that are flourishing? What have they figured out?
Well, in my research with Damian Radcliffe at the University of Oregon on the future of small market newspapers, what we found that's been particularly beneficial has been partnerships. This can be partnerships like content sharing arrangements where maybe some of the daily coverage is partnered with a local hyperlocal online source, for instance. And we see that here in Charlottesville Virginia. We've also seen some really cool partnerships happening with community colleges. And this is particularly true of smaller communities, you know, where the community college might be doing some really cool digital innovations like augmented reality that can then partner with the newspaper to offer something that their customers wouldn't normally see.
Still, you talk about augmented reality, you know, newspapers are supposed to deal in regular old reality. It's just amazing. We just talked to Eric Ayer of the Gazette, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who broke major news for his community, got that big award for it. And it really is an amazing state of affairs when his paper the very next year, Christopher, survive.
It really is. And again, I go back to the first thing I said, which is I think something that surprises a lot of American readers is that investigative reporting, the stuff that wins Pulitzer Prizes and the stuff that is so important to keep the powerful accountable, to report on health crises that would normally go underreported or unreported, this stuff costs a lot of money. It costs newspapers a lot of money. And it is stuff that we depend on to function as a democracy. But unfortunately, it's stuff that isn't driving the revenues. It is absolutely crucial, but newspapers need to find a way to diversify their revenues in order to support the important investigative journalism.
Christopher Alley, Assistant Professor in the Department of Media Studies at UVA. Christopher, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's go from troubles at America's small town newspapers now to one of America's journalism juggernauts. In California, the Los Angeles Times is facing troubles of its own. Tension between employees and managers and accusations of sexual harassment are among the chief complaints at the paper. Despite resistance from management, though, the newsroom voted overwhelmingly to unionize earlier this month. And almost immediately after, the newspaper's publisher, Ross Levinson, was placed on unpaid leave after an investigation into his workplace behavior. On Monday, Jim Kirk was named as editor-in-chief, and he vowed to bring a fresh start to the newsroom at the LA Times. Jim Newton is a former LA Times journalist, spent 25 years at the paper. He's currently a lecturer in public policy at UCLA. He joins me now. Jim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start with the newsroom's vote to unionize at the LA Times. It's something we talked about a lot at the top of the show. What was behind the push for a union at the LA Times now?
Well, keep in mind that the push to get the union began under the previous administration before this group of leaders took over. I think the complaints there range from mishandling of stories to some alleged conflicts of interest to sexual harassment, discrimination. The drive got momentum there, and then when Trunk, which now owns the Times, took over the operation, that only accelerated the drive. And so you had a very overwhelming vote in favor of the union, just as you say, just a week ago.
So all of these things combined to put the impetus behind the union vote. Are employees getting things now that they weren't getting before, or do they expect to?
They're not getting anything at the moment. They still are. The next phase, I think, is to negotiate for a contract. It was a fairly bitter dispute to get it. The current management was sort of condescending and dismissive of the effort early on. So I think it took them a little bit by surprise. But the next phase, I think both sides now have sort of pledged to try to work together and to come up with a good contract that'll bind them going forward. And I hope for their sake that both sides are good to that.
Well, Jim, I mentioned at the top there that Ross Levinson has been placed on leave at the LA Times. A lot of people are saying he's just one example of a newsroom culture at the LA Times marred by discrimination, in some cases, harassment, bullying. You mentioned it. You were there for years. What was the newsroom culture like?
Well, I think the defining factor of the newsroom culture at the LA Times really in recent years has been instability. The paper has gone through more editors and publishers than I can count, really. I was joking with someone yesterday that there was a time, I think I worked for 14 publishers in my time at the LA Times, and I worked for 11 of them in the last like 10 years. It went from, you know, publishers who served for 50 years to publishers who served for 6 months. I think that instability has really prevented them from picking a vision and sticking to it and making decisions based on their long-term future. That's, I think, the really endemic problem of the newsroom. And I unfortunately don't see that ending anytime soon.
Well, then the question, yes, is where the paper heads now. I mean, there is a tie between this dysfunctional newsroom culture at the LA Times and the vote to unionize. It's not just about pay and benefits, although I'm sure it's partly about that too. What's the path forward here in your view from somebody who spent a quarter century in that newsroom?
Well, there's the path that I'd like to see it take forward, and then there's the path that I'm worried that it will take forward. I think what you see happening at the New York Times, Washington Post, that's a quality path forward. That's picking the subjects that you are best at, assigning quality staff to it, building readership, growing. And by the way, I would just like to point out that the editors of both the New York Times and the Washington Post came from the LA Times. So there's no reason to think there's any a shortage of intelligence at the LA Times. I think the path that I worry that the LA Times will take forward is one that's more built on contributors and unpaid offerings to the paper, that so less expertise and more sort of democratized journalism, which I don't think really adds much value, and I think is the wrong path, and I'm afraid is the one they're on.
The future of the Los Angeles Times with a new union and under new corporate ownership. Trunk, Jim Newton, former LA Times reporter, lecturer at UCLA. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
A booming economy was a major focus of President Trump's State of the Union address on Tuesday night. The president, 1 year into his term, took credit for low unemployment numbers, for a booming stock market, but he also took credit for another indicator.
Unemployment claims have hit a 45-year low. And something I'm very proud of, African-American unemployment stands at the lowest rate ever recorded.
Big cheers there from Republicans in the crowd as the president touted the economy. And while the overall unemployment rate is at its lowest in nearly 50 years, 4.1%, the numbers don't really explain why African Americans are still two times more likely to be jobless than white Americans. Here to help make sense of the numbers is William Darity, professor and director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. Professor, thanks for being here.
I'm very glad to have the chance to be here.
Part of the bottom line numbers here, Professor, 4.1% overall unemployment. The African-American rate is 6.8%. Do these numbers tell the whole story, and is the president giving a full picture?
Well, I think the most important dimension of the story is the fact that since we first started collecting this data, the ratio of the black to white unemployment rate has been approximately 2-1. I view that ratio as a strong indicator of the degree of discrimination in the U.S. economy. And so even though the black unemployment rate is lower than it was at previous points in time, it's still twice as high as the white rate. And so I think that that's a signal that we still have a highly discriminatory economy.
The black unemployment rate has been dropping since 2009, along with the overall rate. So those two things have kind of gone together. But you talk about this ratio. You talk about the fact that the African-American unemployment rate is essentially twice the rate for whites, and that basically hasn't changed. What's the force that keeps that ratio in place?
Well, as I suggested a moment ago, it's discriminatory practices in the labor market. One thing that I might add is that that ratio also holds regardless of the educational attainment level of the workers. And in addition, there are sustained periods of time in which the black unemployment rate for blacks who have had some college education is higher than the rate for whites who never completed high school.
The president, like all presidents do, Professor, took credit for the economy during his speech. That part isn't new. He took credit for this one little bit of the economic picture, a relatively low African-American unemployment rate. Have any of his policies in year one contributed to this? Even the tax cuts haven't taken any effect yet.
So the timing of his policies and their introduction is impossible to reconcile with a claim that this has had an effect on the unemployment rate for blacks. But I may also say something that may be a bit surprising. I'm not certain that we can attribute the decline in the black unemployment rate to any policies that were practiced by Trump's predecessor either. Presidents are notorious for trying to claim that good news is due to what they've done and bad news is due to what their predecessor did. I think that what we're really observing is a cyclical swing in the economy away from the conditions that existed during the Great Recession. And in the process, everybody's unemployment rate is going down, but we still have this significant gap between the black and white unemployment rates.
What's the effect of incarceration on the black unemployment rate? Do labor statistics account for it? There are 2.3 million people in prison in this country. African Americans are imprisoned at about five times the rate of whites. Does that affect the numbers?
I don't think it does in a significant way. Individuals who are incarcerated are not counted in the employment statistics because the employment statistics are for the civilian labor force. In addition, there's kind of a peculiarity because the black incarceration rate has been tracking downward in recent years at the same time that the black unemployment rate has been tracking downward. And I don't think that there's any reason to believe that those two facts are consistent with a claim that incarceration rates are affecting the unemployment rate.
What about the effect on employment once people come out of prison, however, and try to join the labor force with a record?
Well, there would be more out of the labor force as a consequence of the downward trend in the incarceration rate, but we don't actually observe a rise in the unemployment rate. So the net effect of that can't be significant enough to explain what we're observing. And I'd go a step further to point out that there's a key study that was performed by Diva Pager, a sociologist at Harvard, who examined the relative treatment of black and white workers who had criminal records versus those who did not. And she found that black workers without a criminal record were less likely to be called back for jobs than white workers who did have a criminal record. So I think that there's a degree of stigmatization against black workers, regardless of whether or not they've been incarcerated, that creates a substantial disadvantage in the labor market.
Professor, you're talking about some long-term and very deep forces pushing against black employment, even at the level of the job interview or the callback. What would a meaningful drop in the black unemployment rate look like? Obviously, those two numbers coming closer together. But what would you look for in the statistics or in studies like the one you just mentioned to show that a meaningful dent in the black unemployment rate was joining the economy?
Well, I think that there's a blog piece that just came out by Algernon Austin at Demos that suggests that if we were to observe a meaningful change in conditions in the labor market, we'd need another 1.2 million jobs that would be held by black workers. And that still doesn't even take into account the question of the quality of the jobs. That is to say, jobs that have secure hours, stable hours of work, solid benefits, and the like.
So if President Trump would like to take credit for a meaningful drop in the black unemployment rate, let's say next year at the State of the Union, or maybe in three more years, what will he have done?
I think if he were to take credit for a meaningful drop or change, we would have to be in a situation where the black rate of unemployment and the white rate of unemployment both were at approximately 3.4%.
William Darity, professor and director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The residents of Memphis can expect their garbage and trash to continue piling up. These men are pretty determined that they want to clean up the city, but they're not going to do it under the conditions that they left.
I started in 1967, April the 15th. So we was there in 68 down the Strat. My name is Cleopha Smith, and I'm still currently employed with the City Sanitation Department.
Cleopha Smith has worked for the city of Memphis for a long time, and he remembers what happened on this day 50 years ago to fellow sanitation workers Echo Cole and Robert Walker.
I was working in the Parkway Village area the day we got the news that those two men's head got crushed in the back of the truck. And what I do remember that we was told to keep on working. We worked until it was time for us to get off from work.
The deaths of Echo Cole and Robert Walker crushed in the back of a sanitation truck sparked the Memphis sanitation workers' strike. Martin Luther King Jr. used that strike to link the civil rights movement to poverty and the treatment of the working poor. King would show up in Memphis that spring. Cleopha Smith remembers the time well.
Well, the wages was very poor, $1 and 60 cents an hour. I think it might have been. The work was very harsh because during that time we was going into the backyard with number 3 wash tubs, collecting the garbage, bringing it back out, dumping it onto a sanitation truck. We really had rough days back in that day and time, and a lot of the workers was really treated like little boys. I'm talking about grown men, 50, 60 years old, was called, boy, do this, or boy, pick that up. So it really was horrible situation back then as workers.
Were you treated that way as well?
Yeah, I were. There was times that when I went into a backyard, they would let the dog out on you. And I guess supposed to be what we call nowadays a prank. And once they would let him out, knowing you was out there, they would call him off. We had quite a bit of trouble to go through in those days and times.
What was it like when the momentum built to strike behind this event?
It was still difficult days because we would march during the day, and during the evening we would go to Mason Temple to get whatever little food was rationed out to us for our families. We just hung out there and stuck in there, as Dr. King told us that we had to march for better working conditions and fair treatment and better wages. We just stuck in there and did as we was told to get this thing to come to a fruition.
And do you remember when you heard that Dr. King was coming to Memphis to join the protest and speak out on your behalf?
Yeah, we was glad. I think at that time it was Mr. T.O. Jones that got Dr. King here to help us in the strike. We are seeing a glimpse of just a glimpse of hope, because we really were struggling, meeting all kind of oppositions in the strike, dogs and fire hoses and mace and all kind of things was coming against us. At the same time, we were determined to stand up and keep on marching.
And Dr. King came to Memphis and spoke at that Mason Temple on April 3rd, is that right?
I was there that night when he made his last mountaintop speech.
But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the star.
And it was raining. It was a rainstorm that night, but the place was jam-packed.
And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world.
I remember the speech, and I think I might have been up on the third floor balcony, but I remember the speech that he made.
And when you and the other strikers, Mr. Smith, left the Mason Temple that night, I guess you got some marching orders. I guess you got some inspiration from Dr. King. But I don't know how you felt as you were stepping out that night into the rain.
We went home with great expectation and great hope that everything was going to be all right according to his speech.
And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain.
That he had been to the mountaintop.
I've looked over.
And seen the promised land.
And I've seen the promised land.
And he said, I might not get there with you, but we as a people, we'll make it to the promised land.
That we as a people will get to the promised land.
Then on April 4th, the very next day, Dr. King was dead.
And that's what we all felt, that all hope was gone. Yep, we felt all hope was gone until Mr. T.O. Jones and another gentleman by the name of Jesse Epps, if I'm not mistaken, picked up the torch and carried it on through.
Mr. Smith, America has seen the famous photos by now of African-American men, sanitation workers, carrying that famous sign, I am a man. You carried one of those signs.
It meant that we was coming out of the boyhood into the manhood. To me, is that we was no longer looked on as boys, but we was looked up to as minions. And it was a great honor to carry that sign. As a matter of fact, I got a couple on my uniform as I sit here and talk to you.
You still wear that slogan on your uniform?
I wear the badge as well as their tie pinion.
That gives me a great sense of history, Mr. Smith, but I wonder why you still have to wear it.
Because I want people to realize that don't know what it means, and if they ask me, then I have the opportunity to explain to them why I'm wearing it and what it means, which I get people asking me from day to day, in the grocery stores, shopping mall, wherever I might go. What do that pin mean? And then I have an opportunity to explain to them, especially our young people, young generation, as to what the pin really means. And they'll say, oh, I didn't know that. That's awesome. Matter of fact, I just left the bank a couple of hours ago, and a young lady asked me about my pin. And I explained it to her, and I told her, I said, because of this pin that I'm wearing, you are able to have the job that you have today. And she went like, wow.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to join us. It's an honor for me to get that sense of history from talking to you and from somebody who's been out on the line the way you were. So thank you.
Well, thank you, sir.
Cleophas Smith is a sanitation worker in Memphis, and he was a sanitation worker in Memphis in 1968 when workers went on strike in the spring. Well, all this hour here on The Takeaway, we've been hearing about your experiences with unions. From Fairfield, Florida, I was unfairly suspended, and the union successfully fought the company and forced them to remove the suspension. Also, thanks to the union, a contract was negotiated with the company where his employees received two raises and a cost of living adjustment per year. Well, that comment came to us through our listener response network. You can sign up to be part of that network. We'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on the show. To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply. And you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, that's text START to 69866 to join our listener response network. It's a great way for you to get your voice into our show. And your voice is one of the most important things to us here on The Takeaway, as we include you in our American conversation. So do join our listener response network. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening and for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.